This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. America's weather is getting wilder and weirder. Record rainfall is drenching the Midwest. Last month was the nation's wettest April in 60 years. And a storm system is pushing from Texas to the Great Lakes, dropping tornadoes in western Wisconsin. One tornado chewed up the Prairie Lakes Estates mobile home park, where Sandra Jackson lived with her family.
We went for cover. I got separated from my husband, and we were in the kitchen, and the roof came off. Shoved my son underneath the kitchen table and laid on top of him, holding on for dear life, and everything's just kind of blowing and going over us.
The tornado killed one man and injured more than two dozen people. It happened in a part of Wisconsin that has not seen such weather in more than a decade.
All I seen was a swirling big black cloud that came over like the top of our house, and just trying to hang on, and the house is completely gone. Everything.
There's nothing left.
Meanwhile, a number of states say they are not getting the disaster aid they need from the Federal Emergency Management Agency, or FEMA, and the Trump administration is proposing cuts to the agency. Some forecasters say this could be another summer of record heat, flash floods, and extreme weather. How well prepared are we? Joining us for the hour is Kevin Klaisel, the director of the Oklahoma Climatological Survey at the National Weather Service. He's an associate professor at the University of Oklahoma's College of Atmospheric and Geographic Sciences, and he joins us from the studios of the university's member station, KGOU. Kevin Klaisel, welcome to 1A.
Oh, it's great to be here. Thank you.
Joining us from Baton Rouge, Louisiana, is Mark Merritt, the co-founder of DCMC Partners, a crisis management and public safety consulting firm that helps with disaster relief. He was a FEMA official during the Clinton administration. Mark, welcome.
Thank you. And again, appreciate having me on your show today.
And Angela Fritz is an atmospheric scientist and the deputy weather editor at The Washington Post and the Capital Weather Gang. And she joins us from The Post. Angela, we'll get to her in just a moment. But let's begin in Wisconsin, where those tornadoes touched down. Richard Kramer is covering the storms and the recovery for Wisconsin Public Radio. Richard, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
How long has this severe weather been going on? I understand that this is not the kind of weather people in Wisconsin get this time of year and haven't gotten for quite some time.
It's a little early. June is typically when we see the severe weather in Wisconsin. Excuse me. And the Weather Service says it's not completely unusual, but it's about 2 weeks early. Generally, this time of year, the average temperature is around 50 degrees. You know, the trees are still blooming, so getting a tornado is pretty strange.
How are the people at that mobile home park doing now?
They are, they were basically let back into the scene yesterday, and as I was going through and talking with them, they were literally picking up the pieces left from their homes. They have all but two people have been staying with family. They've found other places to live. There was one man, I believe, that stayed at the Red Cross shelter. So they're putting it all back together. I've heard that some of the families didn't have insurance on their mobile homes, so it's a total loss for them.
What kinds of weather are folks there expecting now, today and going into the weekend?
Well, believe it or not, there's a frost advisory tonight, so it's pretty chilly right now. It just hit 50, it's about 45 degrees up in the Chautauqua area. The rivers, I'm in Eau Claire, which is about 40 minutes south of where the tornado hit. The rivers are very high right now. There are some flash flood warnings, but no extreme weather that I can see in the next week.
Kevin, let me come to you. In Oklahoma, you're also expecting some severe weather as well. I believe there is a weather alert in effect now for parts of Oklahoma on top of some of the strong weather you've had over the last few days and weeks.
Yes, we've had tornadoes in western Oklahoma, across Kansas over the last several days, and the Storm Prediction Center, NOAA-SPC, who is responsible for doing the convective outlooks and all of the severe thunderstorm watches, the tornado watches, those products are out for most of western Oklahoma and Kansas, where we have a high risk of severe weather today, and that would indicate the potential for an outbreak of tornadoes and large, long-track tornadoes.
How much does the weather you're seeing now square with what perhaps some of the climatic predictions were for this season? Is this looking like what we expected, or is this different?
I think, like Rich mentioned, everything seemingly is running several weeks early, although when we get into May in the southern plains, North Texas, Oklahoma, Kansas, this is fairly typical for what we would see in any given year.
We are speaking to Kevin Klasel of the University of Oklahoma College of Atmospheric and Geographic Sciences, also to Rich Kramer of Wisconsin Public Radio. We welcome your questions and thoughts as well about the severe weather and the nation's response to it. In a moment, we'll talk more about the future of the Federal Emergency Management Agency, or FEMA, but let us know what questions you have about this year's wild weather and also about how the nation deals with disaster going forward, not just storms and tornadoes and so forth, but hard freezes and floodings, earthquakes, and so on. Email us, 1A@WAMU.org, comment on our Facebook page, or tweet us at 1A. Let's add another voice to the conversation, Angela Fritz, the deputy weather editor for the Washington Post and the Capital Weather Gang. Angela, glad to have you with us.
Great to be here.
Talk about the rain that we've been having. This notion that last month was the wettest April for the U.S. in 60 years, and as I understand it, this year could also break some more heat records. Is that right?
Yeah, that's true. What's interesting is that last year, last winter, really, we were in an El Nino, which I'm sure everybody remembers. There was a lot of stories about El Nino. And in those situations, we tend to get a lot of rainfall, especially on the West Coast. And we just didn't see that materialize. Now, all of a sudden, El Nino is gone, and we're actually seeing kind of the El Nino rain pattern that we had expected last year. And so I think those West Coast storms really kind of put the U.S. over the top in terms of our precipitation. And obviously California is slowly working their way out of that drought, which is good news.
Yeah, the drought kind of broke all at once, it seems, in California.
Yes.
With tremendous rainfall, huge amounts of snowfall in the Sierra Nevada. And now the concern seems to be where to put all the water. The ground isn't quite ready for it. We have to be careful when we talk about weather, because there's weather and then there's climate, what we see over time. How much does what we're seeing now fit into what we know, what we might expect from the nation's climate right now?
Right. So people like to say, we can't blame, climate change on any one weather event, things like that.
Right.
But what we can do is we can look back at events, like this in the past and what we would expect and say, you know what, I think these are a little bit different. And something that we can kind of make a pretty clear connection on is the link between a warming atmosphere and heavier rainfall, more flooding, and more drought and more heat waves. And I know that those sound kind of like on the opposite ends of the spectrum, but this is what we expect is more extremes. So you're going to get more extreme flooding and more extreme heat and drought on both ends of the spectrum.
And Kevin, I wonder if it's also worth noting that those extremes also apply to severe winter weather as well as severe summer weather.
Yes, and one of the things about climate change is climate change doesn't necessarily mean that we don't have heavy snowfall. So, for example, Angela just mentioned more moisture in the atmosphere. You can still have cold temperatures in the winter, and with that excess moisture get significant snowfall amounts. So this notion of extremes is not only associated with heat, cold, flood, drought, but also with the ice and snow that you're referring to.
Yeah, perhaps the reason why we have begun shifting somewhat away from the term global warming as a catch-all and more to the broader term climate change to describe more of these extremes. Richard, before we have to let you go, I'm curious about what's going to happen in Wisconsin going forward. What have we heard from the office of Governor Scott Walker in terms of the state's response, the federal government's response, whether FEMA dollars might be coming in, whether the state will accept them? What has the governor said?
Well, the governor's office, Governor Scott Walker, declared a state of emergency for three counties that were hit by these storms yesterday. The tornado went through Barron and Rusk County, a 30-mile path. Everyone's focused on the trailer park because obviously that was where the greatest destruction of homes was. But there was definitely more damage further to the east to a village called Conrath. But state of emergency, Governor Walker is basically urging everybody to document every bit of storm damage they can. It sounds like, without saying it, he sounds to be seems to be leaning towards seeking a FEMA declaration for disaster relief that would hopefully help some of these people rebuild, or at least make a dent in it.
And briefly, in the rest of our hour, we're going to talk more about FEMA and the future of FEMA. Have Wisconsin's past experiences with FEMA mostly been positive?
Well, last year there were two FEMA declarations in Wisconsin. We had some really heavy rain. Far northern Wisconsin, up by Lake Superior, got about 10 to 12 inches of rain in a matter of hours, which wiped out a lot of county highways. I mean, it's a really rural part of the state, too, so there were places where you had to drive 2 hours out of your way just to get what used to, you know, to a place that only used to take 20 minutes.
Right, right.
So the FEMA disaster aid did come through that covered about 75% of the costs and 25%, I can't remember the exact details, it's kind of complicated formula, but it did help local governments. I don't think any of that went to homeowners.
That's Richard Kramer of Wisconsin Public Radio. Richard, thanks for talking to us.
Thank you.
We'll continue our conversation about the future of the nation's disaster relief after a short pause. I'm Joshua Johnson. You're listening to 1A from WAMU and NPR. This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson. We're discussing the country's preparation for extreme weather and natural disasters with Kevin Klasel, director of the Oklahoma Climatological Survey at the National Weather Center and a meteorologist at the University of Oklahoma, Mark Merritt, a former FEMA official during the Clinton administration, and Angela Fritz, an atmospheric scientist and the deputy weather editor at the Washington Post. And with you, what questions do you have about the nation's preparation for the next big natural disaster? Or perhaps what experiences have you had with FEMA if the federal government had to help you through a disaster, good, bad, or otherwise? Comment on our Facebook page, tweet us at 1A, or email 1A@WAMU.org. And we should note, we did invite FEMA to come on the program, and they agreed to do so, but with all of the crazy weather that's going on, they're just too busy to take care of us right now. They're taking care of the rest of the country, which is perfectly understandable. The invitation stands, and hopefully we will have them on in the future. And Mark Merritt, I'm sure you can certainly relate to how busy it can get at FEMA, having worked there for 8 years. What were the major challenges, priorities, difficulties that you recall from the Clinton years of working at FEMA?
Well, thank you. It's not only while I was at FEMA that I have dealt with the challenges, because while there, I was representing the federal government in the disaster process. In the last 24 years, I've been working with the state and locals and helping them deal with disasters. It's all about the quantity and variety of disasters that are having to be responded to at any given time. So as you mentioned before, and some of your other guests on the show have talked about, that you know, we are having stranger, wilder, and more severe weather now that we're having to respond to earlier in the season, when this is normally the prep time for hurricane season. They're spending a lot of time and resources responding to flooding and tornadoes.
Explain, Mark, exactly how FEMA today, anyway, is supposed to work. Let's take a tornado, since that's the example in Wisconsin. Major tornado hits a city, tremendous devastation. We go through the initial disaster response phase, saving lives in the moment. We have a moment, we catch our breath, we survey the damage, and then what happens?
Well, FEMA has always been designed, and you say how it should, and this is how it does work, and I've seen it work through multiple administrations. It is designed to be the resource of last resort. It is, from the very beginning of FEMA, they're there to support the state and local governments when it exceeds their capabilities. So the first responders have the opportunity and responsibility to respond. When the disaster or the event exceeds their capabilities, the state provides resources. And when it exceeds the state's capabilities, then that's when FEMA steps in and supports them and never takes the lead role, always takes a support role.
So this is meant to be kind of a backstop to the state's own disaster recovery efforts.
Correct. And now that backstop, there are also some things that are done before the storm. There's significant efforts that take place in what I call peacetime, and that's in preparedness, training, exercising, and working with those communities that will be responsible for responding, trying to help them better prepare so they can hopefully deal with the issues on the ground.
To that point, maybe you could answer a question we got from one of our listeners. Carl emailed us, isn't FEMA supposed to be a backup to each state's emergency plan? I understand the general concept of insurance, but if I live in an area susceptible to flooding, I have to get flood insurance. Why should I, as a U.S. citizen, have to help support people through federal taxes who live in tornado areas and floodplains? I can see why Trump is trying to lower the budget to shift the cost to the states. Mark?
Well, that's easier said than done. We have prided ourselves in allowing people to live where they can. Sometimes it is economically driven. Some people can't afford to live on top of a hill, so they are forced to live in floodplains. Some of the homesteads have been passed down from generation to generation, so homes were built prior to the detailed analysis of floodplains. So there are a lot of reasons why people live in harm's way, and it's not always for what people think are bad motives. So FEMA is forced to deal with the hand that they're dealt. And so in order to do that, and being a compassionate nation, we like to know that we're there to help our neighbors out. And so they've created a flood insurance program that allows them to spread that risk. But there's also things that are put in place through code enforcement, through the adjusting of affordability of flood insurance and requirements to have flood insurance to get mortgages, to try to discourage people from living in those high-risk areas.
And Angela, I wonder if Angela Fritz, I wonder if part of Carl's question might be affected by our changing climate. I mean, there are plenty of parts of the country that are not kind of the very flat, low-lying rural parts of the United States that are also very prone to severe weather. I mean, parts of Miami, South Florida, where I grew up, probably won't be above water a century from now. There are parts of New York that just dried out from Hurricane Sandy to the point where they can be built on. And let's not forget the big one that's going to hit California any day now.
Right, exactly. And and like he said, you don't want to tell people where they can and cannot live. You don't want to tell cities what they can't do. Most of the time, you know, mitigation and preparation for these changes in climate, things like Sandy, things like the flooding in Miami, you know, Miami floods all the time now. Though that onus is going to be on the cities and the local municipalities to kind of mitigate and engineer their way out of this. And then if it doesn't, you know, if they can't handle it, like, you know, disasters, then the state will take over. But specifically to the listener's question, I don't think people really realize how much federal money goes into every state. And states, it's interesting that the states that tend to have delegations that are most resistant to providing federal aid actually take in the most federal aid in terms of FEMA, in terms of congressional spending bills that are put out there to assist states in general, and also from the HUD budget. And so I think that it would be I encourage everyone to educate themselves on how much money your state actually gets and what you might not be able to do without that money.
And of course, HUD, the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development. And it's also worth noting that there are a number of communities like in and around Miami that have improved their flood drainage and sewage systems and water pipes to the point where they were draining all the water. And then the weather changed to the point where they're not really draining all the water anymore. We're continuing our conversation about the nature's preparedness for disaster with Kevin Klasel of the University of Oklahoma and the National Weather Center, former FEMA official Mark Merritt, the co-founder of DCMC Partners, a crisis management and public safety consulting firm, and Angela Fritz of the Capital Weather Gang, who you hear if you do listen to us on WAMU in Washington, and the deputy weather editor at the Washington Post. Jonathan tweeted us, are there really more extreme or are we just more aware and connected. Professor Claisel, what do you think?
I think there are more extremes. We have long records now, and this kind of ties back to the question that you got earlier. If you live on this planet, you're at risk. Now, there may be varying degrees of risk, but just because we're in one area or another doesn't mean we're completely immune to risk. So there is some type of weather or Earth systems risk to everyone that lives on this planet. And I think the longer we get in terms of the record of floods, you know, we're seeing floods in places that we haven't seen them before. We talked earlier about the tornado in Wisconsin, which is a little bit early for when they usually have them. So I do think that we have a long enough record to be able to determine that some of these changes are actually occurring.
Speaking of flooding, one of our listeners, Beth, says she had 4 feet of water flood her home during Hurricane Matthew. Beth wrote, "I've been in my home for 22 years with the same flood policy. We've had two previous floods that were covered by our policy. But this time, our agency, which she said was the Allstate Write Your Own Policy Program, denied our claim. We have $180,000 in damages, which should be covered by our policy. The FEMA program is so broken, and the government has no one to be accountable to. Until the programs protect homeowners required to purchase this insurance, what's the point?" Mark?
Well, I think there's two issues with that discussion. I think the bigger problem is with the insurance companies, you know, failing to insure for named storms. And I think that's where the problem that your listener had. And I think your other listener had a comment about should the federal taxpayer subsidize people living in places that are of higher risk. So FEMA and the other federal agencies, the administration has to balance that competing requirements of how much do we cover in insurance? So there's a limitation on flood insurance, and the fact that the insurance companies need to stand up and be accountable for insuring their customers. So it's a very difficult balance of how much should the federal government step in and provide for these individuals, and then, you know, how much should we be relying on personal responsibility as well as the private sector stepping in and taking care of what they should be taking care of.
What about that piece of Beth's comment about FEMA having no one to be accountable to? I thought that the whole organizational oversight of FEMA changed after 9/11 when the Department of Homeland Security came about and FEMA developed a different relationship, was in a different part of the federal government. Didn't that change?
Well, it changed, but I would challenge the premise that there's no oversight. There is considerable amount of oversight. Not only are they accountable to the community that they work in, but they also have multiple committees, both in the House and Senate, that they are responsible to, as well as individual senators and representatives that are representing districts that are impacted by disasters. They also have an internal inspector general that is been given the task to ensure that they follow their own rules and regulations, and sometimes those are not conducive to what a survivor might think they want or deserve after an event. So, you know, I would challenge the fact that there's not enough oversight, but unfortunately, when an individual has faced $180,000 in loss, it's hard to understand why someone can't be there to help them.
I'm Joshua Johnson. You're listening to 1A. A number of our listeners in Florida are dealing with some very extreme weather. Julie tweeted, "Let's not forget about the drought in Florida and the swamp that's on fire." Cindy added, "North Central Florida and Georgia are in a terrible drought, high temps and low humidity. We've become Arizona." And I'm looking at the U.S. drought monitor map now for Florida. It looks like everything from a little south of Cape Canaveral, a huge red spot, kind of just north of Lake Okeechobee, and running right up to the I-4 corridor is all in extreme drought in Florida right now. Another listener texted us, "I don't think you can have this conversation about cuts to FEMA without also discussing the cuts proposed for NOAA at the Department of Commerce that provide vital predictive and early warning services for the country and the world." Professor Claisel, could you talk about this aspect? I remember years ago that the National Hurricane Center was the focus of an investigation by the Miami Herald about how the federal government just wasn't funding predicting storms and giving them the equipment they need. Did that ever get any better, or do we still not have what we need for forecasting?
We are in a mixed stage there because we've had a new satellite launch, and that satellite has been providing great service. There are still some areas on the research side that are probably not funded as well, but there has been legislation recently. There's a new weather forecasting bill that President Trump signed recently that it appears to give at least the weather side, the National Weather Service portion of NOAA, the types of things that they need going forward. So I think we're seeing some progress in that area.
And just so that we don't drown in all this alphabet soup, let's clarify all of these different bits and pieces. Explain to us, Professor Claisel, if you wouldn't mind, the difference between the National Weather Service, NOAA, and the Department of Commerce. They lock together, but they're different.
Yeah, the Department of Commerce is the overarching federal agency where NOAA, which is the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, resides. Of course, NOAA, because it has both ocean and atmosphere in it, we sort of refer to that as the wet side and the dry side. Now that the atmosphere is becoming more and more wet, there seemingly has been a lot more collaboration between the ocean side and the atmospheric side. And then, of course, the National Weather Service resides within NOAA. So it's kind of like a tree with Commerce at the top, NOAA within Commerce, and then the National Weather Service is within NOAA.
Angela Fritz, I wonder if you, from where you sit in Washington, have thoughts about what you see in terms of the way that the federal government deals with, funds, treats these agencies that are responsible for the predictive part of disaster preparedness.
You just teed me up for something I've been thinking about over the past couple of months. Yeah, so NOAA is in the Department of Commerce, which in some ways makes sense. It's kind of a legacy thing. But the National Weather Service is in NOAA. And that sometimes, it just doesn't make sense to me, because forecasting extreme weather, you know, protecting lives and property, we're defending against Mother Nature. And I wonder if the National Weather Service and the modeling communities within NOAA would get the funding and the attention they need if they were under a department more like the Department of Defense. Because aren't we defending against destruction? And so, you know, lumping it in with Commerce actually might, you know, kind of backfire a little bit in terms of the priority that things are given. But, you know, I don't think anyone can argue that the Department of Defense has the best researchers, the best scientists in the world working for it, and the best contractors. I believe that that's something that the weather community needs. We need to have the best minds, and we need to throw all of our weight behind forecasting and preparedness.
Mark Merritt, I wonder what you think about that in terms of the way the Trump administration might view FEMA, staff it, fund it going forward. Granted, I know you did work for FEMA under the Clinton administration, so I don't want to put you in too odd a partisan political perspective in terms of your response, but just from a pure disaster response piece, based on what Angela talked about, the president has talked a lot about being very focused on protecting the American people. Do you think that focus, that rhetoric, might maybe augur well for FEMA?
Well, I wish I had another hour or two on your show to have that discussion. and to start with your comment about partisanship, you know, that's one thing I found in my nearly 25 years in dealing with disasters is FEMA is one of those agencies that is truly nonpartisan. And then there's a little bit of politics that goes into it. But for the most part, I have worked in the Clinton administration and worked on the outside, both with the Bush administration, the Obama administration, and now the Trump administration. And we have always found that disaster survivors do not have political affiliation. They are a disaster survivor, and FEMA has always been there when their rules and regulations allow them to be there to provide assistance. Now, I am a big believer in consolidation. I am not, or was not, and still am not, a believer that FEMA should have been put under Department of Homeland Security, but that decision was made. And FEMA has spent, you know, quite a few years trying to integrate itself into the overall, you know, larger organization of Department of Homeland Security. I'm not sure that the disruption to the Weather Service by trying to move them would be in everybody's best interest. But I also agree with Angela that, you know, sometimes an agency like National Weather Service loses some emphasis when they're buried that deep in a larger department like Commerce, the way I feel about FEMA being buried in Department of Homeland Security.
We're going to catch our breath for just a second and get back to our conversation about the future of America's disaster preparedness in just a moment. Stay close. Before we get back to our conversation, we would love your help with a program we're working on about America's white working class. By many accounts, Donald Trump won the presidency largely by appealing to these voters, many of whom said they felt abandoned and taken for granted by politicians in both major parties. If that describes you, tell us what you feel elected leaders and the mainstream media get wrong about you and your issues. Does anyone get it right? And who, if anyone, do you trust to advocate for you in Washington? Leave us a voicemail, 855-236-1A1A, and press option 2. If you consider yourself a white working class voter, what do you feel elected leaders and the mainstream media get wrong about you? And who gets it right? Tell us your story. 855-236-1A1A. That's 855-236-1212 and press option 2. You could also record yourself and email the audio file to 1A@WAMU.org. We will talk about the white working class electorate and share some of your stories next week on 1A. Back now to our conversation about the future of disaster response with Mark Merritt of DCMC Partners, Angela Fritz of The Washington Post, and Kevin Klasel of the University of Oklahoma. Let's talk about the future of FEMA. Part of the future of FEMA, I think, has to do with the way that people just perceive the agency, depending on what end of a natural disaster you're on. We asked people what some of their experiences had been getting disaster relief from FEMA. Here's one message that someone left in our inbox.
Hello, my name is Terry Craig, and I'm from Santa Cruz, California. In 95, Santa Cruz County was declared a disaster area due to rain and mudslides. My family, my home, experienced a catastrophic landslide. Through FEMA, we were able to secure a 4% loan of $200,000. There's no insurance on a landslide. It's called an act of God. So we would have been in terrible, terrible trouble had it not been for FEMA. It literally saved my family.
Terry, thanks for sending that message, and hello out there in Santa Cruz. Now, for every voicemail we got from someone like Terry, we tended to get another voicemail that sounded like this.
Hi, this is Bill from Florida. In 2004, I got hit by 3 hurricanes in a very short period of time. It totaled 2 cars that I had and blew out all the windows and soaked everything inside. FEMA provided maximum of $1,000 total for the 3 incidents to help defray costs. So at the end, I had no money to go toward getting another place. I ended up homeless. I couldn't make first month's, last month's, and security deposit with $1,000.
Bill, thank you for sharing your story. And I think I lived through exactly the same hurricanes you lived through. Charlie, Francis, Ivan, Jean, that crazy season we had in 04. Mark Merritt, what about FEMA's public image? What do you think needs to be done going forward with regard to the way the public relates to FEMA?
Well, I think the biggest challenge FEMA has is managing expectations. FEMA is not there to make you whole. It's not within their authority. The law does not give them that ability, nor do the financial resources in order to handle everybody's claim. So I think once FEMA has done all they can to ensure the communities understand that, I think that will help deal with some of the misconceptions of survivors believing that they didn't get what they deserved from FEMA.
Pause on that for just 1 second. You said FEMA is not there to make you whole. At what point in a disaster recovery does the FEMA team know it's time to pull out?
Well, I mean, that's a complicated question because there's so many areas that FEMA is involved in. One of the primary areas is the public assistance program, where FEMA assists communities to get their infrastructure back so they can start serving the communities. That's the roads that were mentioned earlier in the show, sewer plants, water plants, schools, libraries, things like that. FEMA is there as long as it takes to get those facilities back operational to help the communities. Individual assistance, which is the two individuals that you cited earlier, Ms. Craig and the gentleman from Florida, you know, that's the individual assistance program where FEMA first looks to insurance. Hopefully they can be serviced through insurance. If they can't, then FEMA's individual assistance program is designed to provide them just enough funds to replace their critical items necessary to get them into their home, a hot water heater or a roof or things like that. It's not meant to replace cars or other items of that nature. Now, I can't speak to the individual who had the bad experience with FEMA in 04 because every case has its own merits. But you know, for the most part, we have experiences like Ms. Craig cited that, you know, FEMA or SBA, which in her case of the 4% loan actually came from the Small Business Administration, but it's through the combined federal response to a disaster.
We're talking about the future of FEMA and our disaster response, and a number of you have been sending us your stories of wild weather. We heard about the droughts in Florida. One listener, M, in New Mexico wrote, "We had snow again this morning in Santa Fe and 8 inches of snow less than 2 weeks ago. This is May. There have been several incidents of hail in the last month. March felt like May for a couple weeks, and then May is March weather. Fruit crops in danger. I feel disoriented in the seasons for sure, turning heat on, heat off at times of year like never before." Angela Fritz, is this one of those climatic cycles that the Earth tends to go through, or is this kind of weird weather here to stay?
I mean, I think it's weird weather. I think that, like I was saying earlier in the show, you're going to get extremes on both ends of the spectrum. And as Professor Klaisel noted, you know, it doesn't matter that it's snow, you know, global warming versus snow, whatever. These are extremes. There's more moisture in the air. I think the weather is more dynamic, and you're going to get these experiences. And I think that it's telling that people, just through their own memories, are seeing the changes. You know, right now at this very moment, Wyoming and parts of Colorado are in a winter storm warning. One state to the east, they have a high risk for severe thunderstorms, which is a summer phenomenon. And yes, these things happen in the spring, but this year it seems to be going a little bit longer into the spring.
And Angela, yeah, I'm glad you mentioned what were the weather that people are used to, because maybe Professor Klaisel, you can respond to a listener who's in Norman, Oklahoma. Martine writes, "I've lived in Norman since 1987, and I know my car is being pushed around while I'm driving far more in the past few years than in my first 20 years here. Are the winds stronger nowadays?"
You know, we are looking at some of these high wind days that are increasing over the last several decades. I think, you know, sort of in this whole discussion, one of the things we as individuals have to do is sort of leave the notion of a weather calendar at the door. We have to prepare for everything. And I think, you know, with the FEMA discussion, FEMA is a bookend. There are a tremendous amount of FEMA resources on the front end to help you prepare for all of these different types of extreme weather events. Sometimes we only think about FEMA on the back end, but I think as individuals, if we took more of the FEMA preparedness and mitigation activities to heart and implemented them in our own personal plans, then when these weird weather kinds of things strike and we see more of these extremes, then we're better prepared on the back end and maybe don't need as much of a backstop if we've been more proactive.
And I do want to talk more about that before our time is up. And by the way, I should mention again that we did invite FEMA to take part in the program. They were willing to take part, but with all the crazy weather that's been going on lately, they're just too busy right now. So the invitation stands. Hopefully we will have them on in a future program. Mark Merritt, tell us what your read is on the future of FEMA. First of all, the new administrator of FEMA. Do we know who the Trump administration wants to put in that top job and what his or her credentials are?
Absolutely. I think we as a nation are very fortunate because of the politicization, the politics that have been going on in our country about who's being picked for what job. I think as far as this administration's selection for a female administrator, they have picked probably one of the most qualified individuals in this country to serve in that position. He's a young guy. His name's Brock Long. He has been a state emergency manager director for the state of Alabama. He has been a hurricane preparedness planner out of the region of FEMA that is headquartered in Atlanta, dealing with the Southeast. He spent time with the Hurricane Center in Miami. He's also been in the private sector in a company similar to mine, working with state and local governments, responding to, recovering from, preparing for, and training to be better prepared for disaster. So, you know, we're going to be very fortunate, I believe, of having an administrator that understands the process and is not a political person, but is a true career emergency manager. So I'm very confident that if the funding is made available through Congress, that we as a nation will be fine with Brock Long as the FEMA administrator.
And Mark, I also understand that there's a proposal to change the way that FEMA pays out for damage, kind of like an insurance deductible where the local community would have to pay some in first and then FEMA would kick in. How would that work and what do you think of it?
Well, I don't think it will work, and so that you can tell what I think of it. Hmm. But, you know, a little background. Congress has been looking at the amount of money that is being spent in disaster recovery, and they're trying to figure out ways to reduce that. And so they had tasked FEMA to come up with an idea to reduce the overall disaster costs. One of the ideas that has been presented to the community, the state and locals and the community at large has been given the opportunity to comment on it, is what they call a disaster deductible. This disaster deductible is in addition to the cost-sharing process, which is in place today, where by law, FEMA does not, unless given special waivers, pay 100% of disaster costs. It is a cost share where at least 75% is paid for by the federal government, and the remaining 25% is paid by the state and local governments impacted. Mm-hmm. This would be in addition to a disaster deductible, which would require a state to pay a certain amount before the FEMA assistance kicks in. My biggest problem with that is it does two things. One, it just transfers the cost to the state and local governments. It does nothing to reduce the overall disaster costs. Uh-huh. And secondly, it's not implementable. Dealing with a disaster deductible for every applicant is just not reasonable to expect it to be done.
I'm Joshua Johnson. You're listening to 1A. Before we run out of time, reducing the overall cost of disasters is something that a number of our listeners also were interested in. Kurt here in Washington says heat kills more people than any other natural disaster, but leaves little trace on our cities and buildings. We need to get smarter about the materials we use to build our buildings and roads to help reduce the impact of heat, such as reflective cool roofs and more vegetation. And Ryan tweets, shouldn't this be a conversation about how to rebuild buildings to resist the floods? Why try to maintain something we know fails? Professor Klasel, I wonder, maybe from your perspective, how much of the responsibility for the future of disaster relief falls on us, the citizenry, outside of what the federal government has to do?
I completely agree, and I think a lot of that type of work is ongoing. I think you do see more resilient communities showing up, more resilient buildings, changes in building codes, for example, City of Moore here in Oklahoma. So there are efforts underway in communities around the country to be progressive and proactive as it pertains to building more resiliency to the kinds of weather risks. I also agree with the individual who talked about heat, and that is a really big deal. And if we're talking about the calendar being early, then that means that we may start to see those extreme heat temperatures much earlier. For example, Miami yesterday was their all-time earliest 80-degree overnight low.
Wow.
And that has significant impacts on, for example, the elderly and other vulnerable populations.
One more thing that I wanted to squeeze in, maybe one more comment before we run out of time. Martha writes, I live in Stewart County, Tennessee. Our county director of emergency services wants us to get together with our neighbors to plan for emergencies, but But residential listings have been removed from our phone books, and AT&T wants to eliminate landlines, although a substantial part of the county has no cell service, and landlines are far more practical in an emergency. We've been living here for 42 years, and the climate just gets wilder and wilder. Angela Fritz, I wonder what your take is on how we help people keep up, especially because I agree with Martha, landlines are awesome in an emergency, but in terms of the ability of everyday people to just protect one another, that first line of defense, that first 72 hours, it's so critical. What needs to happen?
Well, yeah, obviously this is a very local level question, and I think that people need to remember to take care of each other. And that's kind of what the whole conversation has been about today, is taking care of each other and how best to do that. Landlines in particular are a big deal. Cell phone towers are a big deal. We talk about these FEMA alerts for tornado warnings and flash floods, but if you don't have cell service and if you don't have a cell phone, which I know that sounds crazy to your listeners, but it happens, especially in these very rural areas of places like Tennessee and Mississippi and Alabama, it's extremely difficult to get these people the information that they need to keep them and their families safe. And so that's something that not only FEMA, but the National Weather Service is kind of racking their brains about right now. How do we keep people safe as technology advances, but a large portion of our population is left behind?
Before we end the hour, and I do want to, Professor Claisel, I want you to chime in one more time, but I just want to suggest a website. The recommendation is that everyone has enough supplies to fend for yourself for 72 hours to build a kit. There's a government website that's terrific called ready.gov, which has information on hurricanes and fires and tornadoes and preparing for just about everything. You'll find a list of basic disaster supplies at ready.gov/kit, K-I-T, ready.gov/kit. Professor Claisel, briefly before we're out of time, what are we expecting from the weather in the next few days and weeks nationally? More severe weather, or is there any kind of relief in store? Briefly.
More. I think that, you know, this is May, and so we have severe weather, and severe weather always comes with multiple risks. That could be large hail, it could be damaging winds, could be tornadoes, flooding, the lightning, so you have frequent lightning with these storms. So I think you have to be weather aware. You have to have ways in which to get weather information. I would suggest when you go to ready.gov and you're making that shopping list, make a battery-operated NOAA weather radio the very first purchase. That will get around the cell phone and the landline issues. So everything you can do to be prepared as we get this wild weather, do it.
That's University of Oklahoma Associate Professor Kevin Claisel. Professor, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Angela Fritz, Deputy Weather Editor of the Washington Post and the Capital Weather Gang. Thank you, Angela.
Great to be here.
And Mark Merritt, the co-founder of DCMC Partners. Thanks, Mark.
Thank you.
1A comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Joshua Johnson. Stay safe. This is 1A.